Percussionist, artist, educator, and producer Chaz Mortimer of Portland, Oregon, with three shakeres and a bell. He runs a program there titled Beats, Lyrics, and Leaders that mentors young people in traditional African and Afro-Cuban jazz forms. He regularly performs with a variety of artists and heads up his own group, Fingerpaint Afro Jazz. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday. No, what am I talking about? It is Friday, March the 13th. I'm a little discombobulated here, but bear with me. I'll be fine. It is Friday the 13th. And a couple of notes before we begin the program proper. You know, this is normally Free Your Mind Friday, and we normally have our discussions back and forth, but today we can't. The phones are being still installed so that we haven't the capability at the moment to engage in a back and forth via the phone. That will happen very, very shortly. They're just about ready to complete that part of the operation as PRN moves into new offices. So I do beg your indulgence and your patience, but we will make up for it, I assure you, because we have missed quite a few Free Your Mind Fridays. And certainly we will make up for that by stretching out once the phones come back, and we can just stretch out and make up for all the time that we have not been able to reconnect with each other. Also, I do know that the disruption, and we explained what happened, that PRN had a kind of 1-2 punch. We had broken pipes that forced the station to relocate. And we also had a situation in which the servers of PRN, as Gary explained and put up on the website, that the servers were hacked and caused to crash. And so there was a feverish rebuilding. So the two things combined posed quite a logistical problem for PRN. But people are pulling through, and we just had to make the best of the situation and go along with the flow, which is what good troopers do, and we are good troopers. But in the meantime, I just wanted people to know that I need your help also in reaching out to those in your circle to let them know that we're back. We're almost in fine form. We'll be fine form shortly. But that you can contact those people who you regularly contacted, as I see on the Facebook page. I really would like your help in reaching out to those in your circle and let them know that we are almost back to normal. And so they should tune in. I do know also that we've had some difficulties with the podcast, but that has been back. That's been back and functioning quite well. So if you've missed any Lead Stories, I recommend that you go back to the podcasts and you can see what you missed and tune in. A couple of programs have had to be rescheduled, and we are making up for that. In fact, that's the case today with this program. We had intended to do this on Wednesday, and so we rescheduled this today. So all that to say, we had a little hiccup, but it was a little hiccup. We're getting better, and we'll be back in fine form in no time at all. But just to alert you, because I know you covet this space that we have on Friday, and I do too. I miss it a lot, miss talking to you. So we will be making up for these missed dates, and we will stretch out, as I said, and make up for lost time. You can be assured of that. Now, I wanted to talk today about the story coming out of Ferguson. On Wednesday, as it turned out, it was a fortuitous thing that we had scheduled to talk about that. Our guest was Alton Maddox, and we were going to talk about Ferguson because it's just a reporter's hunch. You know, the time had come to revisit the seminal question in Ferguson, which was justice done there? And, of course, the release by the Justice Department of a rather contentious report, a report that has been described as scathing and as stunning and other things, but the report nonetheless concentrated on the apparatus of government in Ferguson, and it found rampant racism. It found a number of things out of order, and we will be talking about that. But the report, notwithstanding, seemed to be a kind of, you know, you give with the left hand and you take with the right, or you give with the right and you take with the left. At the same time that this report was released, pointing out that Ferguson had been essentially a kind of Bantustan, the Justice Department, specifically U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, announced that there would be no federal charges against Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown on August the 9th, 2014, and this incident touched off all the most recent unrest in Ferguson and began a chain reaction outside of Ferguson across the country. And it seemed to me that this was an unanswered issue. We got that the report was there. We got that the report contained all of these allegations and had quantified the fact that African Americans in Ferguson essentially were a targeted group. And since then, as you know, there have been many resignations of civil servants in Ferguson, but also major officials, including the police commissioner as recently as yesterday. But at the same time, we still have the unanswered question about the killing of Michael Brown and the fact that the federal position was there was no point in pursuing the prosecution of Darren Wilson at the federal level. The response we got from or the explanation we got from Eric Holder was that the federal standards for conviction under the statutes for civil rights violations were the standards were very high, much higher than at the state level, and so the evaluation was that they were not going to successfully achieve an indictment, and so the federal government decided not to pursue one. As you know, at the local level, there was no indictment either. The local prosecuting attorney, Bob McCullough, after presenting the case to a grand jury, the grand jury came back with no true bill, saying there was no reason to indict. Now, we discussed these things here in great detail, and we went in the minutiae of the law under the guidance of Alton Maddox to explain to you why, as he correctly predicted, and I did too, based on an entirely different thing. His, of course, was specific to the law, And it was my experience in covering these kinds of cases that this case and a related case, that is the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, seemed to be proceeding along a rather predictable line, which would determine in the end, it would be inevitable that there would be no indictment. And so those predictions unfortunately came true. So I wanted to return to this case because the legal understanding of this case needs to be explained. It needs to be fleshed out a lot more, I think, so that you get an understanding as to what the position was of the federal government in this case, the federal government's involvement, and whether, and we come back to the central question, was justice delivered in Ferguson? We know, of course, that the recent events, the shooting of two police officers, has now put another layer on top of this, and it is likely that this would be it is, of course, the story of the moment. And it should be, because it's a very serious development. This is not a good thing, no matter how it happened and who did it or why. I would say, though, that it is too early to determine that this is a one-dimensional issue. It remains to be seen as to who did this and why. But we want to return again to the central question as to whether justice was delivered in Ferguson. Two police officers, as you know, were shot on Wednesday as they guarded the police department building during an hours-long community protest, and they have been released from the hospital. They are said to be recovering from their wounds. And this means that the situation is now compounded. The town may not easily recover from the old tensions, let alone the new, and there is where we are. The shootings occurred the same day that Police Chief Thomas Jackson resigned, the latest in a slew of public employees and officials to quit after the U.S. Justice Department report found an entrenched pattern of racism in the policies and practices of the city's governing and public service agencies. The Department of Justice report came with an anticlimactic announcement that no federal charges will be brought against ex-police officer Darren Wilson for shooting to death Michael Brown on August 9, 2014. The incident, as you know, sparked sustained unrest in Ferguson and sympathetic protests across the country demanding justice in the case. In an exclusive series last November, if you recall that, and you should because that's what I was referring to earlier, the series that we did with Alton Maddox here on Lead Stories, we talked about the fine details of that case. And it seemed as if Holder... Oh, sorry, I should back up a little bit here to recall. The shooting death of Michael Brown began to relate to the Eric Garner chokehold death. It started a groundswell of protest all across the country, and Ferguson became the touchstone for all of it. The hunt is on for the shooters of the police officers. The act has been widely condemned, including by the family of Michael Brown. And we will be talking about this right after this short break when Alton Maddox will join us. Listening to PRN.FM. Alton, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I'm glad to know that. We seem to have had a little kerfuffle. thank you for joining us. I know it's been quite an adventure, but let's start. I want to talk about this report, and from your point of view, what is your major concern about this report in terms of the question, has justice been delivered in Ferguson?
Well, my major concern is that the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, is actually moonlighting as a defense attorney for various white supremacists who pop up at various stages in terms of snuffing out the lives of young black men. And I think what Mr. Holden does not understand, and maybe what we also don't understand as a people, is that the sine qua non of the criminal law is punishment. And when you find no basis to punish someone, it's a green light for white supremacists. I mean, we have really not learned anything over the last 400 years in this country, other than the fact that if people are not deterred from attacking black people, they will continue to attack them. So when you have the Attorney General of the United States saying, for example, that the level of prosecution is very high to convict a white supremacist for snuffing out the life of a black person, and that white supremacist can also be a police officer, it serves a green light. And I think that's what we are saying. We should not be surprised at it. There is no deterrent to snuffing out the lives of young black men, and in some instances, young black women.
Well, let's talk about the application of the law here. The report that the Justice Department issued seemed to suggest that the, in part, that the determination at the state level was not off the mark. That in effect, Michael Brown did have some kind of a scuffle with Officer Wilson, then Officer Wilson, and the DNA was found on the uniform of Officer Wilson that belonged to Michael Brown. And all of these things are circumstantial, but the evidence would suggest, at least they chose to interpret that evidence as suggesting that there was a scuffle and that therefore Darren Wilson acted in, quote, self-defense, unquote. In the strict application of the law, Is a district attorney to determine this, or is a grand jury to determine this?
Well, in the loose application of the law, we won't even get too strict. In the loose application of the law, this is a jury question ultimately. And basically, the maximum that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich should take over, and eventually the matter should be submitted to a pettit jury to determine what the facts really are. So when you have a prosecutor like Eric Holder who decides in the first instance that there should be no civil rights prosecution, you have usurped the authority of both a federal judge as well as a federal jury to decide jury questions.
Does the U.S. Attorney General have that authority in deciding, based on his interpretation of the evidence, and deciding on whether it is on the basis of economy, whether it is a money-saving gesture, or whether it is about the fact that if this case were to go to trial, it would come to nothing anyway, so why go through the not only the expense but the whole process to arrive at an inevitable conclusion? Is he empowered as the U.S. Attorney General, just like a district attorney at the local level, to make that kind of determination as to the inevitable outcome of a case, and therefore taking what would technically be preemptive action by saying, well, this case, it would make sense to not bring this case at all?
No, he is not empowered to do that. And if it wasn't for the fact that you're talking about black victims, nobody else would approve of it, because what the Attorney General is actually doing is overthrowing the adversarial system of justice that exists in this country. And by overthrowing that adversarial system of justice, you're actually taking bread out of the hands of lawyers. And in that regard, you are now dismissing jurors and federal judges who are supposed to carry out their functions. So you have an attorney general here who is actually destroying the entire system. The only reason why there's no protest is because it seems as though in our own community, the consciousness is lacking to understand what this whole process is about. But I can guarantee you in no other community would Eric Holder be able to be doing and saying the things that he's doing.
On the matter of civil rights prosecutions and this claim about the higher standard that must be met at the federal level, that higher standard, according to Holder, is to be able to prove, in this case, that the officer, then Officer Darren Wilson, acted intentionally but motivated by racism and hate. What do you say to that claim about why, and it seems to be the pivot for on which his decision to not indict rests, that this would have been very, very hard to prove?
No, the pivot in this case is not what he's saying now. The pivot in this case is the compromise of 1877. And before the compromise of 1877, there was an all-white Congress that had to decide what was necessary to protect newly freed Africans. And that Congress at that point decided that there were civil rights prosecutions that were necessary. And in 1870, you had the Justice Department to come in to supposedly enforce those rights. Now, Mr. Holder, you know, is not being consistent with history And unfortunately, not too many of us know our own legal history. And so this Congress that enacted those civil rights laws enacted them before 1870. And when they enacted those laws, they were designed to protect blacks. It was only 1877 when the South and the North decided to reunite and make a compromise by snuffing us of our rights that we had this new standard. But the legislative history of civil rights laws in this country are not consistent with what Mr. Holder is saying at this moment. And I would suggest to you that probably when Mr. Holder went to Columbia University Law School, there were no civil rights courses that were offered to the students. And so he has no real grounding in what civil rights really is about. The mere fact that he is the Attorney General of the United States does not mean that he is versed in civil rights prosecutions. And there is no evidence from what I see to show that he, in fact, has that type of competency to be prosecuting civil rights cases.
One of the ironies of the report is that at the same time that he said that these standards are hard to meet on the civil rights level in terms of federal prosecutions, he nonetheless pretty much, at least this is my interpretation, he pretty much legitimizes and proves that African Americans in Ferguson are a class of people, because he did quantify and he did certify that they inordinately were targeted for fines and fees. They experienced inordinately higher rates of arrest and intervention, unnecessary intervention by police. That there was a system that basically used the African-American community as a revenue generator for the city, and even the criminal justice system and the judicial system were part of this whole thing of making the African-American community a kind of money mill. And it would seem to me when he made these arguments, he made the argument essentially that African-Americans in Ferguson, Missouri, are class. Which brings to mind the question about the approach of the family's lawyers in the first place of not approaching this case as a class action, but as a personal injury type case. And certainly at the federal level, the same time that the U.S. Attorney General is saying that you cannot show that Darren Wilson was hateful in his reaction and in his treatment and in the shooting death of Michael Brown. At the same time, he made the case, it seems to me, that the officer, both the officer and Brown, were parts of a class, although different. But in the case of Darren Wilson, he was a member of an oppressive group. In the case of Michael Brown, he was a member of a targeted group.
Well, and I think, you know, and you're absolutely right when you start talking about class actions. And, you know, one of the things that I've said, one of the great things about what Chief Justice Roger Taney said in that no Negro has any rights a white man is bound to respect, that he himself made us a class. And because he made us a class, and because the Attorney General of the United States is reaffirming what Taney said, the upshot of that is that the treatment that blacks in Ferguson have received amounts to a badge of slavery. And that's the reason why I said I don't know whether Mr. Holder is actually fit to deal with the civil rights prosecution of blacks, because he may not have ever learned that the 13th Amendment itself, aside from any of the civil rights laws, not only ended the institution of slavery, but the 13th Amendment ended all badges of slavery. And the word badges of slavery is something that is seldom used, and I don't believe that most lawyers understand that aspect of the 13th Amendment. But since Mr. Holder is considering blacks in Ferguson as a badge, then certainly the mistreatment of those blacks would be in violation also of the 13th Amendment, in addition to the civil rights violations that he claimed that he can't prove. Because the reality of it is he has already proved a constitutional violation just simply in the way that blacks in Ferguson are being treated.
So when he issued this pronouncement that there will be no federal indictment, which compounds or reaffirms the decision at the lower level, he in effect is saying, this, for all intents and purposes, this case is over. Is this case over?
No, it's not over because of the fact that double jeopardy does not applies until there has been a criminal conviction. So, you know, anybody else could take this case up and run with it totally different. And that's where the black community itself comes in. You know, something I learned very early in life is that the greasy, in terms of noise, that, you know, when you have noise, you have to apply grease to the wheel that is making that noise. And so this is a situation where we are having a lot of disturbances, but nobody's making any noise. And if the black community decide that they are going to continue to be quiet and allow Holder and Mr. Obama to mortgage the future of our children, then that's a sad commentary on who we are as a people. We should be making the loudest noise possible right now, and every black person should consider himself or herself as not being an innocent bystander and being actively engaged in expressing views in many ways possible. There's a lot of things that we can do that we are not doing. And by not doing it, what it's going to do is going to usher in a Loretta Lynch with the burden of the precedent that Mr. Holder has set, in that civil rights laws in this country are out of business.
What then is the legal challenge here? If you were to, let's say, pick up this, this just theoretically, on what grounds would you confront this decision by Eric Holder?
Well, the one thing that happens here is that while he is the prosecutor in this case and certainly has greater authority than many of us, because he can impanel a grand jury and we can't. But he certainly cannot stop us as a class from initiating federal litigation claiming violation of the Constitution, and particularly the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, and going at it in that particular way. So, you know, while he himself is saying that, well, we're not going to do this, that's only as long as he's there. Now, Loretta Lynch can absolutely decide to do something totally different. But in the meantime, we as a people have to initiate and undertake our own obligations, and that's where we are now. What do we plan to do? If we start dealing with our so-called leaders, we're not getting ready to do anything. If we decide that this has to be a grassroots approach, and that we're going to take this upon ourselves to address this problem, then, you know, we have an opportunity and a chance to be successful. You know, we don't necessarily have to follow the leaders that we have because they have never done anything. I mean, for example, I'm the only attorney in the United States who's ever gotten special prosecutor in two cases, not any of these leaders. So why would you be following these leaders and they have gotten zero results? So that's really where we are as a people and where we decide we got where we're going. If we are impressed with title holders and people who have titles and black faces in high places, then we're going nowhere. If we decide this has to be a grassroots approach and we look at this in terms of our own personal obligation and in terms of self-help, then I think the ball really begins to roll.
I'm curious about one aspect of this case, and that is the prosecution, or the at least the intended prosecution, under civil rights statutes. Why is it? Is it because an African-American person was involved, or should this case have come under I'm curious about, in other words, the civil rights designation of these kinds of cases when they arrive at the federal level, as opposed to a prosecution, a plain prosecution at the federal level. What's the reason that these cases inordinately go the civil rights prosecution?
Well, that's an excellent question, because in situations such as this, the reason why they go the route of federal civil rights is because those laws are written in the federal codes. So, you know, if you look at Missouri, for example, it's just a straight out murder. So the United States government could not intervene in a murder case where Missouri already has murder statutes on the books. But in a case where Congress has decided that there should be additional jurisdiction, this is what gives somebody like Eric Holder the opportunity to act. And as I said before, what more importantly is, when these laws were written, the Congress was all white. And when these laws were written, they understood that persons of African ancestry had to be protected. And so nothing has changed since then. It's just that Eric Holder is refusing to look at the legislative history of civil rights prosecution. That's the only thing that's happened, because it's very clear. The Justice Department came into existence after these laws were written in order to enforce them. I mean, so the question here becomes that of history. And unfortunately, many black lawyers do not know that much about legal history. And the case of Brown versus Board of Education is evident of that, because Thurgood Marshall and his group were in the Supreme Court, and the justices of the Supreme Court asked Thurgood, did he know the legislative history of these statutes that he were relying on, and he didn't. And so they had to take a recess of several months for him to get up to speed on the legislative history, and after he did, he came back and was victorious. So that's my point. You a lot of times have lawyers who are not competent to engage in this kind of prosecution because they have not studied enough in this area to be effective.
I want to talk about the one of the glaring omissions here, in terms of both the exercise of his authority and the content of his report, and that is that he seemed to not at all address the conduct of the case at the local level, at the county level, under Bob McCullough, the prosecuting attorney in Ferguson. Now, why would that not be part of what he should be looking at, considering that there were so many comments and criticisms and glaring, I mean, we talked about it on the program, glaring inconsistencies in the way this case was handled.
Well, you see, this is the problem here. The problem is that if the Attorney General of the United States wanted to address this matter in a meaningful fashion, then what he should have done was to have convened a grand jury and to authorize the grand jury to investigate this case, not for him to just issue a report of his own. That was an abuse of authority right there. That's what should have been demanded. If he decided that he wanted to look in this case, he should not have said that I'm going to look at this case myself. He should have said that I'm going to let a grand jury look at this case and make recommendations as to what should be done as a first step. Now, if the grand jury came back and said, well, our recommendation is that you should prosecute this case, you know, then if he needed cover, that would have been his cover. But to take this on his own and then to have punked out, you know, and that's a word that he likes to use, the word punk, to have punked out in this matter is where the problem is surfing, because here you have a situation where you have personally indicted the city of Ferguson for widespread racism, and yet you come back and punk out when you need to have a grand jury to indict somebody. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, on one hand, there's all kind of racism running around in Ferguson, and then on the other hand, say, well, we can't indict nobody. And that's what he has done. And that's where the inconsistency is. And if he was afraid to actually convene the grand jury himself, he should have convened a grand jury to issue a grand jury report first, and then after the report, take the action of that grand jury and use that as a justification to going after Darren Wilson.
And this is after a member of this grand jury actually is insisting that the case be looked at more closely, because this is a case of grand juror Doe, and he's being represented by the Missouri ACLU in this matter about his complaint that the grand jurors were, under Bob McCollum, were misled, given erroneous directions in terms of the law and the application of the law and so forth. These would seem to be very serious concerns about the integrity of the state prosecution process. And it would seem to me that it would have given Eric Holder ammunition to do exactly as you just said.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, this is where the whole process has gone awry, because Holder, on one hand, is usurping the authority of both a federal judge and a federal grand jury, and on the other hand, he's turning around and appeasing the police department for their violations of civil rights. And then he expects everything to be hunky-dory afterwards, and it's not.
The report has caused a great deal of a shakeup in Missouri, in Ferguson in particular. But you have a couple of people who have resigned and so forth. But of course, we know the way things are organized. It's like shuffling the deck chairs on a Titanic, to quote an often used simile. Do you believe that justice has been delivered here by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder?
Well, no, I don't. You know, and this is why it's more particularly hard for me to deal with this, because of the fact that I was a defense attorney. I had no power to impanel a grand jury. Ms. Griffith and the family contacted me and said that they wanted me to represent the family. And, you know, they felt that I was the only person to do it. And I was very hesitant to get involved in on that level, because I didn't think that once I stepped on the toes of New York State that I would have anybody behind me to support me.
And you're referring to the case of Michael Griffith.
Right. I'm referring to the case of Michael Griffith. And what I knew was that in this city at that time, black could not walk into any of these neighborhoods without being accosted. And so, you know, it was a widespread citywide problem. And so, you know, when they asked me to get involved in it, you know, I didn't want to. But when I finally decided that I would, I understood that the ultimate goal was to make safe streets, safe cities. I mean, that's basically what it amounted to. You know, not just simply pursuing one case in one neighborhood, but actually setting a precedent to bring this whole thing to a halt. And so, you know, in that process, the first thing I did was justice comes in different flavors. And I think one of the things our community need to do is to bone up on what is the definition of justice and what's the classification of justice, and to recognize there's a big difference between personal justice, like in personal injury, and preventive justice. And when you're talking about preventive justice, you're talking about the type of justice that will deter others from engaging in this kind of conduct again. And so we were able to eventually get convictions in Howard Beach. However, I did not believe that that was going to be enough of a signal for white supremacists in other neighborhoods to get the message that assaulting and accosting black people in the city of New York was an expensive ordeal. And so we worked on a few other cases, and I had to come up with the strategy. What did we do? And finally, we had the case of Yusuf Hawkins and Bensonhurst. And the upshot of that case was is that Joseph Farmer got 33 years to life. And basically what has happened since then, you haven't really seen the white vigilantism that we saw beforehand. And so, you know, and so a lot of times it may take more than one case, but if a defense attorney who has no money and no resources can be able to do what I was able to accomplish here in New York, then you certainly would expect that a person who is the Attorney General of the United States should be able to do much more than what he is suggesting that is in his disposal at the present time.
What should what should happen next in terms of, from your perspective, as a strategy, what should happen next?
Well, I think one of the things that has to happen is that we must recognize that when a family is aggrieved and it chooses personal justice over preventive justice, that family has lost its authority in any respect to speak for black people. Now, you know, we all agree, we all feel for the Brown family, and we know that a tragedy occurred. But the Brown family has no business in any way under the sun of speaking for black people, because they chose personal justice. And personal justice usually end up in hush money. And hush money is usually based upon how well are you valuable to the system. None of that is helpful to black people. So, one, we need to understand that concept. There's a big difference between personal justice and preventive justice. The second thing that we need to understand is that we can't afford to have an ambulance chaser representing the family. So that, you know, this is an area now where we've gone beyond the law enforcement authorities protecting our rights. Now we got to choose an attorney. You don't end up choosing an ambulance chaser like Benjamin Crump or like Daryl Parks to represent you. And so that's where we are next in this area, is finding out whether the availability of some people who are serious and who are about to take this action in a very serious form.
So there we are. The situation in Ferguson, from your perspective, is that no justice has been delivered there. The U.S. Attorney General would have made his exit, and he's expected to do that very soon upon the confirmation, presumably, of Loretta Lynch, that he would have made his exit with a kind of 1-2 punch. The same hand that giveth taketh away. He gave a report, but no justice. And even the report itself is of questionable value in that it does not actually take definitive action, and it does not really indicate that it is solving a problem. It just highlights the problem. It doesn't say who is going to be punished, who what is going to be done to restore justice in a town that he took great pains to point out has been existing as a Bantustan for many, many years. So one wonders, what is the Obama administration's commitment to these kinds of communities, also taking the tact that Ferguson is not endemic in America. It's not typical of what's going on in black communities in America. And yet we know that that's not true. We know that there are aspects of this going on in almost every city or community that is predominantly black, but predominantly white controlled. So on that score too, I see that there has been a troubling propensity to create an alternate reality. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I think the main thing that we have to do is send a signal now before the Obama administration leaves, is that we do have no intention of mortgaging the futures of our children for anybody, including President Obama, and that whatever we have to take, it has to be taken. But to sit here and to think that we are going to allow a black president to leave office with some grand reputation is something that we're not going to permit. And I think black people got to get real. We did all we could do for this man, and he's done nothing for us up to this point. And he should not leave in office unless he leaves in national disgrace.
I want to thank you very much for your time today, Alton, and especially for your spirit, your technological the technological adventure.
Well, we want to thank the Cotton Club and Brother Grayson and others who have been here, and Curtis and everybody else trying to put this together. The only thing I had to do was sit in the hot seat. They had to deal with the technology of us getting this message out today.
Thank you. We will return, of course, to normal very, very shortly, and we wouldn't have to kerfuffle anymore. But I look forward to you coming back and doing for us these. I want people to understand what they're getting when we talk. And what they're getting is not just a college education, but a law school education. And
they're actually getting more than that, because in law school, the one thing you don't have in law school is the requirements that we talk about. And I've always said that in law school, you have to have the equivalent of a baccalaureate degree in black history, the master's degree in legal history, and a doctorate in military science.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I really do appreciate your time. And we will be talking again soon, because I do want you to walk us through some of these cases, these landmark cases that continue to reverberate today as they do in Ferguson, Missouri. Thank you so much, Alton, again.
Thank you for the invitation, Utrecht, and thank you everybody here at the Cotton Club for making this possible.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecht Lead. Next week, I'm looking forward to us